A government is a territorial monopolist of compulsion and agency, which may engage in continual institutionalized property rights violations and the expropriation, taxation, and regulation of private property owners. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. Today we have Per Bielen, the author of The Seen, The Unseen, and The Unrealized, How Regulations Affect Our Everyday Lives. He is an assistant professor of entrepreneurship and Records Johnston Professor of Free Enterprise in the School of Entrepreneurship at Oklahoma State University. Mr. Bielen, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
What is economics?
Oh, good question. There are plenty of definitions. Most of them are probably wrong. I think in general, I mean, the economy is simply how we use scarce resources to satisfy as many wants as possible. And economics is the study of that whole system. How did we get to where we are? Sort of the wealth of nations question that Adam Smith had back in 1776 already. But also, where are we going from here, and what are the alternatives? Where could we have been, and how does it work? I mean, that's pretty important. I would stress that it's more about understanding the mechanisms and the processes than it is to actually measure or predict and forecast things.
So originally, I was under the impression that economics is something that started in like the 1800s when there was a stock market and we could measure the Dow Jones or something like that. Turns out economics is something you embrace in your everyday life, whether you're dealing with money or just time. Could you give me an example of how people engage in economic thinking in their everyday lives?
Well, sure. I mean, every time you spend your money would be one. Every time you make a decision, it's really one. Because every time you make a choice, there's a trade-off. Do you want to do this, or do you want to do any of the other things that you could have done instead? So, I mean, simple case would be in the morning, do you go to the bathroom or do you postpone it and do something else right now? I mean, that's sort of a value calculation. So what are you going to do with your time and your effort right now? So that's like a tiny type of example. But that's how the world works, right? And that's how we interact with people. That's why we choose to do certain things and not others. And all of that is, of course, our own subjective evaluation, our own subjective preference of the alternatives that we personally are able to see. We're, of course, not considering alternatives that we're not aware of. And any long-term plan that we make, that we make the trade-off between the present and the future. So when we're going to work, most of us are probably not going to work because, oh, damn, I would really enjoy working right now. That's not the issue, right? Instead, we think that, well, it's an economic calculation that if I work today, I will get a salary in the future, and I will need that salary in order to spend on food and shelter, but also on things that I enjoy doing and things that I enjoy having. So it's an investment for the future. So economics is all around us. It's everywhere, and we're doing it all the time.
Now, the Austrian School of Economics is unique in that it begins with the starting point that recognizing that human beings act, as opposed to the average economist will start with like the unemployment rate, something that is many meters down the thinking of where you would actually start. What is the importance of starting with humans act when engaging in economic thinking?
Well, plenty of things. I mean, one thing is simply that you don't get lost because you start at the very bottom or at the very, very core of what we're talking about. And from there, as Austrians do, build up and derive truths about the economy and our choices based off of the fact that we act purposefully. We're acting in order to replace what we have with some better situation that we consider to be better, right? Non-Austrian economists tend to start halfway. So they start with a phenomenon that they have measured, and then they look at correlations between aggregates. So you mentioned unemployment rate, and then they say, oh, well, there's also the interest rate. And then they look at the measures of those, and how do they seem to correlate? Well, that doesn't really tell us anything at all about where either of them come from, what they might otherwise look like, or why they seem to correlate. Right, so you're asking different questions, really. Right, so Austrians are trying to understand society in a sense, whereas modern day economists dealing with these aggregates, they're really, in a sense, engineers, wannabe physicists, in that they want to measure and they want to put into equations and they want to solve problems for society. But Austrians recognize that we're individuals, we're part of collectives as we choose, but we're all acting purposefully in some manner. And it's not for us to plan, it's not really for us to control, and we most likely cannot even do that. So we cannot get the outcomes that we think that we can calculate, because people might choose differently, people might value different things, and people might simply change their minds.
I want to ask a question about your book, The Seen, the Unseen, and the Unrealized, How Regulations Affect Our Everyday Lives. You open up with a discussion about the value of the entrepreneur. So many will say the capitalist entrepreneur or business owner is a parasitic exploiter who simply sits back and gets rich off the backs of the workers. How would you respond to that mindset?
Well, I mean, yeah, it is common. It's pure Marxism. So just pointing that out might actually take some people out of it. But the point is that value is really always in the eyes of the consumer. So value is the satisfaction we get out of something. And the reason that we get paid to produce something is because we're expecting it to have a price, and we're expecting consumers to buy the things when they're done. Right, so the role of the entrepreneur is really to imagine some way in which consumers can be made better off, and then put everything they have on the line. So they're either taking out loans or using their own savings, and they're paying people to work for them. They're getting renting resources, they're buying inputs, and they're changing all of these into new types of combinations where they produce something new for consumers. They still don't know if consumers will actually buy the stuff, right? So if they're successful, then the consumers will pay a price for it, and the price is higher than the cost or what the outlays that the entrepreneur has. And that means that, well, the difference is the entrepreneurs. And the entrepreneur can then reinvest in the business and expand and satisfy more consumers or do something else, whatever it is, right? So it's the worker himself is, yes, contributing to the process, but the reason that work is valuable is because the entrepreneur has discovered how to satisfy consumers. And the reason the worker gets paid, whether or not the business does well, is because the entrepreneur is bearing the uncertainty.
And coming up with the idea and constantly innovating to keep up with competitors. Every criticism that the Marxist has of the, you know, the entrepreneur-employee relationship also applies to the customer-entrepreneur relationship. In other words, the customers are saying, give us what we want or we'll go elsewhere and you won't get any money. It's like, well, that's not really exploitation. That's, you know, giving incentives to create products and services that you value with other people you want to cooperate with. So is there anything else? I want to ask you about the labor theory of value specifically. Is there any insights you could have on that? Because it's coming back in a very big way. Ocasio-Cortez, Congresswoman, says that she has a plan to not nationalize Amazon, but turn it into a worker cooperative, because they're the ones who do all the work. How do you respond to the labor theory of value mindset that not that all labor is value, but all value comes from labor?
Well, I mean, in a sense, the argument is that, well, and if anything is to be done, any production is to be done, workers are involved. There is at least human labor involved. So it's a necessary component in production. And I mean, of course, we agree with that. I mean, there's no production unless a human being is involved. That's human action. That's what it is. But so that something is necessary does not mean that it is the only contribution to value. And of course, we have plenty of examples where workers are paid and they do a lot of work, but there is no value in the outcome. All of the failed businesses are just like that, right? So, and all the businesses that go under, even if they have been profitable before, they're also examples of that. So the workers get paid into the very last week and then the business is gone and someone loses their money, but it's not the workers, right? And at the same time, you know that there's not really a correlation between the number of hours, which is the classical definition of it, that the number of hours put into producing something is what determines its value, right? That's where Marx was, that's where many of the classicals were. And that's obviously not true. And I talk about this in some of my classes at Oklahoma State too, that if I, a nobody pretty much, were to produce a painting and I suck at drawing and I spend 1,000 hours doing it, it doesn't mean that you will pay a lot for it. But if someone famous, if someone really good at painting would produce something in 1 hour, people would pay a whole lot more for it. So obviously the value is not correlated to the labor. Now you can say that I suck so much that my labor is worth less, but then you're sort of shoehorning a solution into it. So you're really making the explanation the goal of it. So you're changing the reasoning upside down. You're starting with saying that, well, it has to be labor, and then you're making up reasons for why it could be labor. Right, and that's not a very good explanation, if it is at all an explanation, right? I mean, it's actually pretty bad, but I think it's intuitive for us, because after the fact, when we make these choices, we choose between different outcomes, and we're willing and able to put into more effort into something that we think will be more valuable, right? Which means after the fact, it looks like the more people work, the more value there is. Yeah, because they chose to put more value, more work into something that is more valuable, right? So you wouldn't put in a lot of work in something that you think is it's a little bit of value. So there is a correlation after the fact, but it's because of how we choose. But we choose based on the value of the outcome, and then we choose to put a lot of effort into it. So what I usually say is that value determines cost. It's not the other way around, right? So that's how entrepreneurs work, and that's how we work in our everyday choices too. I mean, the entrepreneur sees a solution that he or she thinks is really valuable, and then after that, they say, well, it's this valuable for a lot of people. That means I can probably charge a price of this many dollars. Then the calculation is, can I produce this at a cost that is lower than the price that I think I can charge for it, right? So the role of the entrepreneur is really to figure out how to produce at a cost that is lower than the price, and that's how they earn a profit. So their incentive is to produce value in the most efficient manner possible. I mean, first discover what could be valuable, and then produce it in an efficient manner. So of course there is a correlation with labor, but that's not it. Some people put a lot of labor into stuff that is not worth the damn thing.
Unfortunately, yes. I've been there myself. Let's say I am someone who simply just cares about those who are in poverty, whether it's in America, Haiti, or Bangladesh. I want to make sure people have at least the bare minimums, food, water, clothing, shelter, access to health care. Why should someone like me care about or support free markets?
Well, that's where value creation happens. It's really that simple. So 300 years ago, everybody was toiling in the fields, and most people were slowly starving to death all their lives. Today we're not. Today we have an obesity problem instead, right? So we obviously have way too much eat, and we have I'm not going to say too much comfort and convenience, but we have a lot of it, right? And we choose it. So we're a lot wealthier today, and wherever there is, I mean, if you look at it historically, wherever there has been more entrepreneurship and more markets, the wealthier people are, and the more prosperity there is in society. And that's what Adam Smith asked. Where does the wealth of nations come from? Well, it comes from entrepreneurship, hard work, sure, but smart work more than hard work, right? Because people were toiling in the fields for thousands of years and toiling as nomads before then, but they didn't get very rich. They stayed just as poor as before. But then with human ingenuity combined with smart work, we created better solutions and we raised everybody's standard of living. And of course, we see the other the trend going the other way in societies trying to distribute value instead of creating it. It goes downhill, right? So it's pure decline. So people are getting poorer. And you can take a rich country like Venezuela, lots of oil reserves and everything, and then you start on the sort of the socialist track, and pretty soon people are going to start eating their pets because they don't have any food, and they're going to have a shortage of a toilet paper like they had in Venezuela. And suddenly the oil wells seem to dry up because no one can figure out how to get the oil out of there, and especially not in an efficient manner anymore, because there are no profits, because there's no economic calculation, and there's no sense of what is valuable. And why would there be? Because why would you strive to produce value if you don't get to keep it yourself?
Sure. How can we measure the standard of living? You know, I'm sorry, I should have said this first. When we're looking at, you know, economic growth, very often the stock market will be mentioned, or gross domestic product. However, if we drastically just inflate the currency, then we could have trillions of more dollars without any actual increases in production or standard of living. So what are some valuable ways we could actually measure improvements or decreases in the standard of living within a given society?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, there's a reason why Austrian economists are not a whole lot into the measurement bit, because the economy is always changing, and perceptions and valuations are always changing too, meaning that whatever you measure, it's going to be wrong in a lot of senses, right? GDP is a terrible measure to begin with, because it's called gross, but it's really net. So it's confusing already the term. A better one would be gross output, which tries to capture the whole productive structure and see where are the investments and what is going on in the economy, rather than how much output was there. But neither is really a good measure. Instead, I would probably say, I mean, some kind of well-being measure would be better, since that is what we're getting. I mean, the economic growth, people go, well, we don't need more money, or we don't need more stuff. But the importance with economic growth is really, well, we're curing diseases. We lead longer, happier, healthier lives. That's really what matters, right? Not that we have iPhone 35 in a couple of years. That doesn't matter as much as getting another 20 happy, healthy years in our lives. So some kind of well-being measure. We could look at health. We could look at anything that matters to people, really. The problem with these measures is that different things matter to different people, and different things matter to people at different times. So, I mean, the way we measure, for instance, inflation, looking at a basket of goods and how expensive is it? Well, the same basket of goods 20 years ago and now, no one would buy that basket today, right? Because we would buy different things. And instead, what they're doing then is changing the goods in the basket so that it represents a normal buyer. Well, then you're not measuring the same thing. So what does it actually mean to follow that over time? And when GDP is also, as you mentioned, it's the dollar value. So if you inflate the currency, then GDP is going up a lot. And then you're adjusting that for inflation, but the inflation measure is faulty as well. I mean, then you have a faulty measure using a faulty metric that you're adjusting with a faulty metric. Where do you end up with that stuff? It means, as an Austrian, I would look at the market process, and I would just say that, well, if the market process is not hampered, if it's not manipulated and distorted, it's going to produce as much value as is possible. And entrepreneurs are going to try to figure out ways to serve themselves by serving others. And since this process, it's going forward, it's progressing all the time. And what matters is really that it's as little restricted as possible at any time. I mean, that's the most important part.
What do you think about, there's two that I sort of look at and find very interesting. Let me know if I'm totally off on these. The one that I look at is percentage of a given populace that has the ability to afford certain items. So number of households in 1970 that had access to computers, TVs, phones, internet, and all this stuff. Okay, not 1970, 1990 versus today. And then we could look at the number of households, what percentage of people have access to those. Or maybe we could look at the number of hours it takes to acquire the wealth. I could see that being sort of a hedge on inflation because, you know, it costs a lot more. Yeah, but we earn a lot more. Maybe you could say something like, well, it takes, you know, 2 weeks' wages to get a refrigerator today when 100 years ago it was a year's wages, something like that. What do you think about percentage of households that have access to certain goods and services or number of hours it takes to acquire certain goods and services as possible measures of standard of living?
Well, the second one is probably better. I mean, when you're looking at how long will you actually need to work, and I mean, it's on average. It depends on your job and all this stuff, right? So it's still I mean, it's a very crude measure, but still, it gives you an idea of how valuable your labor is, which means really how much are entrepreneurs willing to pay for it, and what can you get for it. So it gets to the productivity of labor, which is really the core of production in the economy. The other measure is I think is definitely worse, simply because what people want and what people have changes over time. I mean, one example would be a landline phone. If you go back 100 years, very few people had a landline phone. Well, we're getting there again now, right? Because people have cell phones. So if that is the measure, then you would have like a peak in economic prosperity in, I don't know, 70s, 80s, or maybe 90s, and then it's going down again. Well, it's not going down in terms of the standard of living. It's just that the number of landlines is going down, because why would people have a landline phone, right? You can have one in your pocket instead. So it's going to be really hard to find one product that people actually want, or even if you have like a basket of goods, a set of products that people want and people have, and that is a measure of their well-being. I don't think there is any such constant in the economy or in society. And there's also an Austrian point, right? That they're in the economy because everything is produced based off of our perceptions and our likes and our fads and all this stuff. There are really no constants between measurements, right? So you can't say that, well, between this measure here and this measure here, it's always 1.2 in size, right? So because people change their minds and they change their behavior, and they change their behavior based off of how other people change their behavior and all this stuff. And it's really based off of our perception of what we find satisfying or valuable. And I mean, you might enjoy a filet mignon, and I might too. But after the 20th straight day having it, I'm going to want to go for something else, right? Even though I love it. But 3 weeks straight, nah, that's too much, right? And so you can't really, there's no constant. I mean, there's value to it, but after a while, I'm going to get fed up and I would like some variety. And what am I going to choose then? Well, it depends on all the impressions on me during this time. And at that point, what do I have to choose between, which in turn depends on what have entrepreneurs produced meanwhile and have offered to me in the market. And I can't know that either until I'm actually in the market and see the products. And then I can, as a consumer, choose between them. Right, so there are very few things that we can just measure and look at the correlation and look at how they move together or not, because it's all temporary. It's ephemeral.
Now, what are some real-world examples of free markets giving us better results for the average person than socialist economies?
Well, I think there are plenty of examples. The problem with empirical examples is that you can always find some aspect that it does not completely fit. And therefore, someone can always say, well, have you thought about, and then they bring up some detail, right? One example that I like to use, since I'm from Sweden, is Sweden. And Sweden is a sort of a free market success story. where the country in the late 19th century, say around 1870 or so, was one of the poorest countries in Europe, and had at that point a very influential and vocal classical liberal sort of free market movement, and they had a lot of impact. So Sweden deregulated pretty much everything. The king was restrained, his powers were restrained, the parliament took over instead, which meant a lot of freedoms. There was freedom of expression, lots of entrepreneurship going on, free international trade pretty much, all of these things. And that led pretty quickly to Sweden getting rich. Of course, at the same time, after around the 20s and forward, with the 1920s, Sweden started building a welfare state, but the welfare state grew rather slowly. It grew slower than the economy. And it was sustainable because Sweden was not part of the world wars. So after each world war, Sweden could be there, like Swedish industry, like, hey, here we are, we can produce for you guys. And all the other countries around Sweden, all of Europe was basically devastated and destroyed. So they needed to buy a lot of stuff, right? And then in 1970, something changed and Swedish welfare state went completely radical and went berserk in a sense. And it took 20 years for the welfare state and the sort of success story of Sweden. When in 1970, Sweden was the fourth richest country in terms of GDP per capita. And in 20 years, Sweden imploded and basically went bankrupt in 92. And after that, Sweden has sort of tried to find its way back to more market. But that's one example. And of course, Venezuela, as I mentioned before, is another example of embracing and implementing socialism, and then everything goes down the drains, as it usually does.
Sure. Yeah. We also have examples like India becoming more free market in 1991, I think the year was. We have North Korea and South Korea, East Germany and West Germany. Yet we're still called the, you know, fanatical ideologues who just think in theory and don't have any real world examples, even though we have them all around us constantly.
Yeah. A classical one would be Hong Kong, right? Which was just a fishing village, pretty much. And pretty much forgotten too by the English Empire. So the governor there could do whatever, and he just refused to tax people and refused to legislate a whole lot. So it was just a free market going from a fishing village to a financial center of the world, from pretty much nothing to one of the richest parts of the world in 100 years. Of course, it could go faster, especially today. So all you need to do is just get rid of the state and all these regulations, and you could have a lot of wealth very quickly.
Now, the subtitle of your book, The Seen, the Unseen, and the Unrealized, is How Regulation Affects Our Everyday Lives. If I'm the average voter in America, I might say, well, regulation is a thing that business just deals with. It's not like it really affects me. How does regulation affect our everyday lives?
Well, it affects everything, right? So what I talk about in the book is try to, because we know, or at least we as economists or interested in economics, we know that regulations, they have sort of a dampening effect on value creation in general. So we know that regulation is a cost because people can't choose the optimizing alternatives. And that's way too short-sighted for me as an Austrian. And so what I try to do in the book is talk about, okay, well, if you regulate a little bit over here, how does that affect everything else in the economy? Because everything is really interconnected. So there are no parts of the economy that are sort of independent from all the other parts. So I try to follow those processes and the sort of ripple effects through the economy, showing that, well, this little regulation, I have a sort of a fictional little society in the book where I follow maybe a dozen people with, they have different professions and do different things, and they have different aspirations and life goals and so forth. And I follow what happens. So I walk through the logic and their choices based on what they prefer and their transactions and exchanges and value creation, all their entrepreneurship and what have you, without regulations. And then I add one regulation to the story. and see, okay, what are the differences? Well, it turns out that there's much less division of labor and specialization, meaning there's less productivity overall. A couple of these people in this society, they do not get the type of job that they were dreaming of, where they would be more productive and produce more value for people. Instead, they were stuck in their old occupation because the opportunity, it was never there because of that regulation that really had nothing to do with what they were striving for, right? So it sort of caps a lot of opportunities on the production side, which means a lot of good jobs get lost that we otherwise would have. So it's not only about the actual products that we choose from in the stores and the conveniences we get as consumers, but it's also the opportunities we have to form and develop careers, develop new products, and create new wealth. So I'm trying to sort of shed light on this whole process and how it affects us as both producers and consumers. And we all are, right? So we all are, we're having jobs, or we're going to have jobs where we make money. We produce things that are valuable to others. We get money, and then we spend them on things that we like. And imagine if the opportunities to get employment are severely circumscribed because of regulations. Well, that means we're going to have less money. We're going to have less enjoyable work. So we're going to be more depressed in general. And for that lesser money we get paid, we can choose from worse products than we otherwise would have, and probably at higher prices. Well, that's a pretty dismal view, right? that really sucks. And it's really easy to show this if you walk through the logic, but it's really difficult to show this through real world examples. Because real world examples, you can't follow along and you can't show what it otherwise would have been. So that's the point of the book, right? The unrealized part is that, well, look at all this stuff we could have had and we would have had were it not for regulations. Those remain unrealized and we might not ever get them.
There's so much there. Two of the biggest unseens that we have are a guy named Elvis Summers in Los Angeles and Jay Austin in Washington, D.C. They were solving the problem of homelessness about $1,000 per. It wasn't a shed, but these were small houses that would have given homeless people a place to live, a microscopic amount of money, which could have been raised voluntarily as it was. So why hasn't it been solved? Of course, because the state in both cases, I'll attach the video I did on this in the description. The state basically said these homes don't count as homes. They're not up to regulation. So we have the right to determine what is justified property and what is unjustified. These conditions don't appear to be safe for us. So this is what happens, you know, with the lockdowns. Another example of regulation is, well, they'll say it's wrong to make someone get a driver's license to vote because, you know, that'll stop millions of people from being able to vote. Well, a driver's license takes a day to get, and yes, it's bad because you have to go to the DMV. But think of the hundreds of thousands of legislation, regulations, lawyers you have to hire to start your own business and get a license. That stops us from having way more options in the market. You have fewer options as a consumer. You as an employee have fewer options of where to go. It's harder to say, you know, to tell your boss to go to you know where if you're not happy with it. You have less choices. We're overall less wealthy. That's what I really like about the book. I haven't finished reading it, but I've really enjoyed that chapter on entrepreneurship. Any final words on regulation?
Well, I guess not. I mean, it's really hard for people to understand what the impact is because they don't realize that it affects them as both producers and consumers. So they don't realize that they produce less, they have less value in their lives that they can use for other things because of regulations restricting entrepreneurs to find better solutions for consumers. And with the lesser wages they earn, or they work longer hours for the same amounts or something, they have worse products, fewer products, and more highly priced products. So, I mean, they're in a sense, they're losing at both ends, right? So lower pay and higher prices for crappier goods. That's not really something that is on, say, the working man's side or anything like that. It's exactly the opposite. I mean, if regulations does, if they do anything at all, then it's protect the incumbents from competition from better entrepreneurs, right? So it's really a way of stopping progression, stopping economic growth. That's what entrepreneurs do. I mean, in a sense, it's just a regulation raises barriers. That's what it does. Right? It's a restriction. That's all it is. And I guess one other thing to add is that any regulation, since it is only a restriction, it cannot bring about what they promise because it doesn't produce what they promise. Right, so they say a regulation should lead to something, but that's not ever what a regulation does. A regulation is always a restriction of something else, right? So the minimum wage, they say that people should make more money, people should have higher salaries. Well, the minimum wage does not give people higher salaries. It just says you cannot have a job that earns a lower salary, right? So it's a restriction, meaning, of course, if you think about it that way, you realize, well, wait a minute, if you restrict those jobs, well, that means anyone who is not productive enough yet can't get a job where they have to pay you more, right? So a lot of people are going to be ending up with unemployment because of this. So it's really a lie to say that the regulation should lead to whatever it is they're selling it as, because it's not that. What they're doing is they're restricting one thing, saying that, oh, this will lead to this other thing we're not restricting right now. Right, because we're outlawing this, then we're going to have this. It's like saying that, oh, we want more people to drink Pepsi, so we're prohibiting Coca-Cola. Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that people drink more Pepsi-Cola. It does mean that less people drink Coca-Cola because it's illegal. Right, so that's why regulations almost never actually bring about what they promise. Because it does not actually do what they promise. It does something else. It restricts other choices and thereby tries to force people to behave differently. But people make other choices than the planners had in mind.
Do you think that's why there's so much overlap between people who advocate a philosophy of freedom and people who study economics, simply because you don't know people's individual circumstance? You don't know what's best for other people. You don't know what options they have. You don't know what goals they have. So you want to make sure you're doing the absolute least amount of coercing them or initiating aggression against peaceful people as possible. Is it just me who sees that big correlation?
No, I think you're right. I mean, in studies on different disciplines on university campuses and so forth, how left-wing or right-wing are people, then usually economics is the most right-wing, which typically means it's like 50-50 between Republicans and Democrats, and all the other disciplines tend to be heavily leaning towards Democrat. I'm not sure that measure matters much at all. I mean, Democrats and Republicans, they are pretty much the same to me anyway. But it makes sense because economics traditionally, now it's a lot of math and hocus pocus, really. But economics tradition you learn in the introductory courses is really the logic of how you have spontaneous orders in the economy, right? So that you have automatic economizing on resources based off of supply and demand curves, but really people's choices, and that people come together around a market price, which in turn guides both producers and consumers whether they should produce this product or this other product, whether they should consume this product or this other product, because they have different prices. So it's really a bottom-up type of explanation, giving you insight into that all these things that seem to work, but no one really knows exactly how, because no one planned it. They work because no one planned it, right? And that's the beauty of economics, uncovering that mechanism. Whereas I don't think any other discipline or school of thought really even tries to understand this, but rather they want to go in there and manipulate the metal with it and make it better somehow. Whereas economists understand that this is really hard stuff, and this is really impressive and important that it works.
Sure. What is the socialist calculation problem? I know you touched on it earlier. Could you give us some insight as to what it is and why it matters?
Sure. Yeah, it matters simply because socialism cannot work. It's really that simple.
And I'm sorry to interrupt you. Just to the definition that I usually use is the institutionalized aggression against private property or state ownership of factors of production and distribution. What is that more or less the definition you're using when you say it can't work?
Yeah, it's the economic system. So it's really the public or state ownership of the means of production. Right. Okay. So there's one owner of any, all factories and trucks and roads and everything like that. There's just one owner and one decision maker, whether or not it's a committee of planners or just one dictator, doesn't really matter, but it's one will, right? Instead of the market system is different because there are all these entrepreneurs and they own their little chunk and they try to do as much as possible with it and figure out what to do with it. And the argument is simply that, well, we don't know exactly what consumers want. Consumers might not actually know what they want until they see things. And what they do is choose between the options they have and choose whether to choose one of those options, right? So they have some purchasing power and they have all these different options. Well, how can they get as much value as possible for their purchasing power? That's a problem that they're trying to solve, right? And entrepreneurs are trying to second guess what they would like most. Because the problem there is that production takes time. So when you start production, there's no way of knowing whether consumers will like this or not. And you don't know how much, right? Because you don't know people, you don't know what they will want. And you also don't know what other things people, other entrepreneurs will produce, right? And in a very advanced economy, it's not just one entrepreneur with a piece of land producing something for the consumers directly, right? Instead, you have thousands and thousands and millions of entrepreneurs producing all kinds of stuff that we as consumers never thought of that is important for production of the consumer good, right? All these tiny little things that we have no clue, that's just there, like the little rubber ring that's inside the cap of on a bottle to keep it tight so that the contents do not escape. Well, someone thought of that, someone produced it, and someone bought the inputs and the machinery and put everything at risk to produce those things in a certain way. And others probably tried this in different ways and they were not as successful, so they failed. Right? Everywhere you have this trial and error process, everything is moving around all the time. And the result is economizing on resources. Because what entrepreneurs do is they have this idea, wait a minute, there's steel out there. I can probably produce something, let's call it an automobile, out of steel. And I think consumers will value it at really highly. So they will pay a high price, which means I can bid for the steel because a lot of people want to use steel for different things, but there's not enough for everyone. So I can bid higher than other entrepreneurs for the steel, right? Because I think that what I'm producing is worth so much to consumers in the future when I'm done. Other entrepreneurs make similar calculations. They go, well, wait a minute. So I can probably get a price this high for these goods and I can sell that many. And I need these inputs. So I can bid up till this level for those inputs and still make a profit and still make ends meet. But I can't bid higher. Well, that bidding process means that you get market prices for the means of production, right? And whoever bids the highest is the person most convinced that he or she can produce highest value for consumers, right? So they are going to get the resources first and the second guy second and so forth, right? So whoever is not producing a lot of value is not going to get the resources, but has to choose something else. Of course, entrepreneurs choose different types of inputs based off of these prices. So entrepreneurs collectively, they determine these prices based off of their best guesses, what consumers will want and what they can charge for those products. That's how they set the prices in the bidding war against each other, in a sense. And then the one entrepreneur is choosing between these prices, picking the cheapest way possible to produce the good for consumers. Well, what this means is that you have a number in the same unit, monetary unit, for all kinds of resources everywhere. And this unit, this number, the price, is set by everybody who's interested is involved, using the best possible guesses that they have, right? And they all have their own money on the line, right? So it's not just simply, I don't know, I don't care, right? Because then you can get a resource, that's no big deal, right? If I wanted to get all the hot dogs in Walmart, I could go there and I can just say to the store manager that, hey, I'll pay $1,000 per hot dog. Well, I could get all of them. That's not the issue. The issue is bidding against each other and getting those resources that do not directly satisfy us in the right hands where we can get as much as possible out of it. Right? Because otherwise, there's no way of knowing, economically speaking. So Mises has this discussion about building a house, and you can think about building a railroad. If you build a railroad, first of all, an entrepreneur needs to say that, well, this is probably worth it because I think there is enough value in having a railroad between these two cities. That's the first decision. But even assuming that there should be a railroad, which central planner wouldn't really know, we just have sort of societal plan without any value involved. But if you say that we're building this railroad, economically speaking, the entrepreneur would just respond to the prices out there. Right? They would pick a material that works engineering-wise, and then he would pick the cheapest possible way of doing it. Right? So we waste as little as possible of the resources and get the output. For the central planner, well, there are no entrepreneurs, there's no pricing of the good of the means of production, there's no involvement of all these guesses and all these entrepreneurs trying to create value at all. So what the central planner has is, well, we have a bunch of gold and a bunch of steel. We could use some for a rail. Okay. So we can check with the entrepreneur, with the engineers, excuse me, and see, okay, what works? And they say, well, gold and steel both work for rails. That's fine. Okay, well, which should he use? Well, which is in most scarce supply? Which is worth most? That's what he shouldn't pick, right? Well, there's no way of knowing because you don't have any prices for this stuff in a socialism. Because there's only one making all the decisions for production. So you have no prices. You don't have all these different ideas that are sort of competing for the resources, which means the Central Planning Committee would not be able to say, if it's economically speaking, that is from the point of view of consumer satisfaction in a sense, that economically speaking, is gold or steel better for rail? They would not be able to tell. An engineer can say that, well, maybe gold is a little softer, so that's not a good idea. But economically, there's no way. I mean, are you going to build out of the most expensive, the finest steel possible so that there's no maintenance at all for 100 years? Or are you going to pick the cheapest one that you will need to maintain every other year or even replace every other year? Which one is better? Well, you need prices to say that. If you don't have prices, you're completely blind, right? So that's what Mises discovered about socialism. Because you don't have prices, because you don't have what he called the division of intellectual labor with all these entrepreneurs putting their own money on the line, because you don't have that, there's no way of figuring out what would serve consumers best. Well, if you can't figure out how to serve consumers best, that economy is not going to do very well. There's going to be a lot of waste, and there's going to be a lot of products and services that consumers would benefit from that they will never see. All right, so that's why it can't work.
One may claim that when we are in a state of freedom where there is no state regulating what goes on in society, much like an owner regulates their dog from engaging in troublesome behavior, if there's no state looking out for us, then we will be subject to big, big monopolies that will strictly restrain our ability to make decisions and be almost tyrannical in a sense. What is the free market response to the potential existence or existence of monopolies?
Well, I tend to say that a monopoly is really something produced based out of economists' models. So it's not really relevant in the real world, because how do you become a monopolist? If you think about the logic, if it's a completely free market, then there are really no barriers to entry. So any entrepreneur can start a business whenever they discover an opportunity. Well, how do you grow big then in such a market? Well, you grow big by satisfying consumers really well. You produce something cheaply that consumers are willing to buy in massive amounts, or that they're willing to spend a lot of money to buy, right? And then you make a profit, and then you expand, and then you can continue that, right? You get bigger and bigger because you're serving consumers. Well, that's really something that would attract entrepreneurs to compete with you, right? So they would do the same thing, or they would try to do it better to just undermine your situation completely and get the profits. Okay, so in that case, if you become a monopolist, meaning the only seller of something, that means that you're good at producing what you're producing, that no one else can compete with you. Well, that means that consumers get the most possible benefit from what you're doing, even though you're only one. Because you'll always have to have the problem, of course, with someone else might get another idea and someone else might figure out a better way of producing it. So there are always potential entrants, potential competitors, right? So you have to still produce a lot of value to maintain your monopoly situation. But that's not a monopoly that is in any sense harmful for consumers. That's a monopoly because no other entrepreneur is able to do a good job compared to this guy, right? So that's not a problem. And of course, we know that any such product, there's going to be a disruptive innovation eventually, or people change their minds or something. So this is still only temporary. The problem that people have with a monopoly is, I think, really that they think that, oh, well, they will just take over the market, meaning they will be the only seller, and then they will jack up prices and they will lower the quality and they will spit in the consumers' faces. And that sort of thing. Well, in a free market, if someone gets into that position and then they say, well, screw you, consumers, because now I'm jacking up the price like crazy, like they did with insulin or whatever it was. Well, then that's a signal for other entrepreneurs to say, hey, wait a minute, plenty of profit here. It's easy to produce something lower than this guy's price now that he just quadrupled it. Right, so there will be competition immediately. So you can't really raise prices and you can't really lower the quality because that's an opportunity for other entrepreneurs. So you can't really exploit the situation of that you're the only seller, because as soon as you do, someone else will enter, which means you're not the only seller anymore, and which means that you are really the worst of the producers. So the only way of exploiting a monopoly situation is if you're protected. And the only way of being protected is to have a government regulation force others to not enter and compete, right? So the only way a monopoly can be harmful to consumers is if it's a monopoly created by government. Because in that situation, you might have plenty of entrepreneurs who want to compete with the guy, but government says, if you do that, jail, right? Well, in that case, that monopolist can say, oh, look at that. I'm just going to raise prices a little bit. I'm going to fudge on the quality a little bit, and then I'm going to restrict output and increase my profits. Well, no entrepreneur can enter because government still says, no, it can be only this guy. So then you can screw over consumers because you are protected by government. But the problem then is not that you're the only seller. The problem is that you're protected by government.
Exactly. And that's exactly what happened with insulin. Check the description and first comment below to get a little more insight on how the insulin example is the perfect example of how in the absence of coercively stopping people from innovating, we would have an abundance of access, just as we have an abundance of mouses. I mean, this amazing thing was like $5. So, I mean, we would be able to innovate our way out of things. We see constant innovation and lowering prices in the healthcare realm with something like LASIX that's much less regulated. We see very low prices in Uber and Lyft and Airbnb, whereas when the state gets involved, they just leave California in the case of Lyft, or they stop us from having any of these other terrific things that consumers desperately want. I got three more questions for you, and they're more or less very similar. What is the most important contribution made to the field of economics by Adam Smith?
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that's a very tricky question, because it depends on if it's actually a contribution or not. So there's a lot of research on where Adam Smith got his ideas and his examples and everything like that. And if you go with Rothbard, for instance, Adam Smith was one of the worst things that happened to economics. So, I mean, he had some important thoughts. I mean, the division of labor is one, where he starts out talking about how productive we get by simply splitting processes into specific parts where we specialize to do those, and thereby we cooperate through, as though guided by an invisible hand, through prices. I mean, he sort of laid the foundation for economic thinking in connecting those two ideas. But I don't think either of those are his own. I mean, division of labor was known before that, and I think even the pin factory example from his book is stolen. I mean, back then they didn't actually cite sources a whole lot, so I guess he's excused. But I've read somewhere that example is from someone else who wrote about it before, but Adam Smith got some of the numbers wrong, so it's not correctly copied. And the invisible hand, I mean, that's a great expression. I think he uses it more often in Theory of Moral Sentiment than he does in The Wealth of Nations, where I think he only mentions it once. But I mean, I would say, in terms of his own contribution, the main thing that he did was start a discussion on economic theory. So the following 150 years, everything started with Adam Smith, and tried to explain Adam Smith's book, tried to explain the mechanisms, tried to figure out the details, tried to add to it. Right, so that's his greatest contribution by far. Not anything in the actual book, but everything that followed from it. So I mean, there are other economists who I think are probably, well, who are, in my view, a lot better than Adam Smith, but Adam Smith's greatest contribution is making the field of economics a field, pretty much.
Now, if we take something like rent control, the average person might say, well, all right, there's a bunch of places and we got a bunch of homeless people or people who could barely afford to get into these places to live. So let's just have the state control the rent, lowering it to where it otherwise would be. This way people can afford to live there and not just the bourgeoisie, Per Bielans of the world, get houses. How would you respond if you're trying to get someone into the economic thinking regarding rent control?
Well, I mean, one thing would be to talk about the incentives, say simply that, well, those who own those buildings, they have no incentive. If you force down the rent, they have no incentive for upkeep and maintenance. There's no reason whatsoever to do that, because they can't raise the rents. So they will, as soon as you have a price ceiling, the only way of making ends meet and earning a profit is to cut costs. And cutting costs would it at some point, and probably very soon, mean that you're cutting corners, which means that you will have a lot of buildings that are not very nice anymore pretty soon. And that's what we see in most inner cities where there are rent controls, that those are nasty places to live simply because none of the landlords have any incentive to renovate or even work with upkeep. So they do the minimum required by law, I suppose, and if even that. I would say the stronger argument is the long term, that if you regulate the rent, no one else is going to build new buildings because they can't cover those costs. So that's expensive. And if, say, you could be able to, in a free market, people would be willing to pay $500 for an apartment, say, and you set rent control to $300, well, building that house is going to cost the same. So the question is, when are you going to pay off that loan that you're taking out to build that house? Well, $500 a month, $300 a month. $300 a month is going to take a lot longer, right? So which means there are other ways you can use that money that would pay off the investment much sooner. So why would you choose building a house? Of course you wouldn't, which means that as time passes by, we would have a whole lot less housing available, which is exactly what you do not want if the problem is homelessness. You want more houses. And you want houses of different qualities and different locations and so forth. And you want entrepreneurs to build houses for the rich so that the rich sort of abandon the houses that they have and the rent falls for those and others can move in and get fancier apartments at a lower cost. I mean, that's how the market works. That prices fall and quality goes up and people lead better lives. So it's always the case that when you regulate the market, you only restrict and you place an enormous burden on the actors in the economy. And you're never going to get exactly the result that you hope for, that you use to sell the regulation. It's always the case.
And final question, who is your favorite economist of all time, and what do you think are their most worthwhile contributions?
Wow, okay. Had you asked me a couple of years ago, I would have said Ludwig von Mises, without hesitation. After that, I've been thinking that maybe Karl Menger was an even better economist, just thinking, I mean, Mises is fantastic, don't get me wrong, but Menger started something completely new, and the way he thinks about things and the way he talks about subjective valuation and how that determines production and how that determines prices of the means of production, how he talks about stages of production and explains the whole economy from the point of view of entrepreneurs anticipating the value that consumers will see in the products that they're haven't seen yet. All of this stuff, considering the situation he was in late 1860s, early 1870s, I just don't see how that is possible. If he was not sort of, if he maybe he had access to a time machine or something like that and could go into the future and learn, but that's just amazing. And that beats the other sort of the masters of the marginalist revolution at the same time. And he's so much better. But then, of course, Mises builds off of Menger and has a lot of very nice contributions on money, solving a huge problem there, on the socialist calculation debate. I mean, Mises started that single-handedly. And praxeology, the true method of economics, was really formalized by Mises, even though it's used by Menger too, but Menger didn't formalize it. So, I mean, it's one of those two, for sure. But right now, I'm sort of, it's a toss-up.
Sure. And the book to read for Menger is Principles of Economics, the one that people should check out? Or is there another one I'm missing?
Yes, definitely. And what's so wonderful with that book is that it's so easy to understand. So even if you're a beginner and you don't know a whole lot of economics, you can actually pick it up and read it from page one and just read it through as a book. I mean, it is economics, and don't get me wrong, but it's easy to understand and it's very readable and it's even enjoyable, even though it's economics from 1871. And you can't really say that about picking up Human Action by Mises, for instance, because a beginner would not get a whole lot out of it because it's much more detailed. It's much more, it's harder to read in general. So Menger's Principles, that's actually a book I recommend for beginners to just get a starting point. as long as a book, of course. So, I mean, if you want something shorter, you want to do something else. But I assign a lot of manga in my course when I teach Austrian economics to undergrads.
Well, what is your, I believe the copy I have is like 193 pages. The Seen, the Unseen, and the Unrealized is the book, How Regulations Affect Our Everyday Lives. Isn't it like 190 pages?
Could be. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, I wrote it.
I think it's a terrific
words.
Introduction. I thought it was so easy for me to get through. So, of course, check out in the description. You will also have the homelessness and the insulin videos that I mentioned as well. Thank you to everyone for watching Keith and I Don't Tread on Anyone. And Professor Beeland, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.